This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Not so sugary sweet.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the Morning Open. A look at the economy as trading gets underway for the day. Let's ask that question, where's Wall Street? Markets are up right now. The S&P up about almost 1%, 0.9%. The NASDAQ up more than 1%. The Dow up about 80 points at 10,103. Shares in Europe up right now 1.5% to 2%. And Asian markets closed higher today as well. The Hang Seng by more than 1.5%. Saying it makes strategic and economic sense, Kraft Foods has made a bid, a hostile bid, to take over British candy maker Cadbury. The feelings, though, are not mutual. Kraft offered the $16-plus billion, essentially the same bid it informally made a couple of months ago. That bid was resoundingly rejected. Marketplace's European correspondent Stephen Beard is with us live from London right now. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Steve.
So Kraft was under the gun, wasn't it? The company had to get an offer on the table today.
Yes, under British takeover rules. These are rules designed to stop takeover battles lasting forever. If Kraft had not tabled its official bid today, it would have been forced to walk away from the bid and stay away for at least 6 months.
For at least 6 months, yeah. But why didn't Kraft increase the offer that it made earlier?
Kraft is under pressure from its own investors. Warren Buffett has got a stake in Kraft, and he's made it pretty clear that $16 billion is enough for Cadbury. So Kraft now has made its official bid. It'll now sit back and see if there are any rival bids. There haven't been any so far. There's been some suggestion that Nestle or Unilever might be interested. They haven't joined the fray yet. But you know, Steve, even if there are no new bidders, Kraft may have to increase its offer if it wants Cadbury. Some of Cadbury's investors have said they want the company to remain independent unless Kraft is prepared to pay a lot more money, up to $18 billion.
All right. Marketplace's European correspondent, Stephen Beard. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Another get-together, perhaps. General Electric and Comcast are closer to a deal for Comcast to buy a controlling stake in NBC Universal. They've reportedly agreed to value NBC at about $30 billion, but there are a lot of speed bumps on this road to marriage. As Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports, the federal regulators are going to hear from consumer groups who are against the deal.
Public interest groups point out that Comcast is already the biggest cable company in the U.S. They worry that if it acquires control of NBC Universal, it'll both produce and distribute NBC shows and restrict competitors' access to them. Jeffrey Chester is with the Center for Digital Democracy.
The merging of Comcast and NBC Universal is equivalent to Godzilla swallowing Rockefeller Center and using the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree as a toothpick.
Chester also says Comcast would raise cable rates to help pay for the NBC Universal deal. The Federal Communications Commission will evaluate any deal to see if it's in the public interest. Either the Justice Department or Federal Trade Commission would look at antitrust issues. A GE spokesman declined to comment. Comcast didn't respond by deadline. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Cutting-edge technology companies such as software developers and biotech engineers will be watching the Supreme Court closely today. The justices hear arguments in a case that should clarify what innovations can be patented. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
10 years ago, a Pittsburgh company tried to patent a way of trading commodities contracts, but the U.S. Patent Office decided it didn't fit the definition since it wasn't a new machine or transformative process, and the Court of Appeals agreed. But Mike Jakes at the Finnegan Law Firm says the company had good grounds for appealing to the Supreme Court.
The real question is this an abstract method or not? And we don't believe it is because it's an actual method that can be used to manage consumption risks in a commodity market.
But Stephen Schreiner, a patent attorney with Goodwin Procter, says that innovation was more an idea than an invention.
So the court's view was that applicant was trying to patent this broad concept of hedging using contracts.
Lots of high-tech companies worry a narrow patent definition will jeopardize their rights to idea-based products like software or even pharmaceuticals. They're hoping the Supreme Court rules in their favor next spring. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Goldman Sachs has been working hard to spiffen up its image ever since it awarded huge bonuses to execs after getting government bailout money. In an interview with the Times of London, Goldman CEO Lloyd Blankfein said he believed big bonuses were a sign that the world economy was recovering. And he said he believes banks serve a social purpose and are doing God's work. Blankfein added that other banks made no money and still paid large bonuses. And he says he understands that people are angry with bankers' actions. Quote, Blankfein, I know I could slit my wrists and people would cheer. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report for Monday, November 9th, 2009, at marketplace.org. So far this year, 115 banks have failed, and experts think there are still plenty more to come. How can you tell how a bank is doing? One predictor is the so-called Texas ratio, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports. It's one test where getting a high score is a bad thing.
To calculate the Texas ratio, you take the bank's non-performing loans and divide that number by the tangible equity capital plus money set aside for future loan losses. Are you confused yet? Bart Narder follows banks for Celent, a consulting firm. He has a simpler way of explaining it.
It's essentially bad stuff divided by good stuff.
Put that way, it's easy to see the logic. The more good stuff you have on your books, the better shape you're in. When the ratio of bad stuff to good stuff is around 1-to-1, the bank is more likely to fail. And there are plenty of banks whose Texas ratios are right around there. Georgia has the most because banks there were overexposed to bad real estate, but Florida, Illinois, and Minnesota are all well represented. Narder says it's important to realize a bad ratio doesn't guarantee failure.
It's a ratio like many other ratios that should be used as a guide. It is a reasonable snapshot. It does not predict the future.
And there's a twist. The ratio's accuracy depends on banks reporting their own losses.
That number is subjective. You sort of have to guess at that one.
David Byme is a finance professor at Columbia.
And there are banks that do that conservatively, and there's banks that do that less conservatively.
He says it is possible for a bank to be too honest. If they report tons of bad loans and rack up a high score, their Texas ratio could turn into a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
It was two decades ago today, people started gathering atop the Berlin Wall to chip away at it, chunk by chunk. East and West Germany were reunited. Throngs of people merely walked over. But a lot of East Germans drove their cars to the other side. The car was the Trabant. Many of them had that car, and Marketplace's Amy Scott reports there's a plan now to revive it.
During communist rule, the Trabant was the cheapest and most popular East German car. Today, an old model sits in a museum in Berlin.
It's all plastic, only plastic.
That's historian Stefan Wolle. Not only was the Trabi, as it was called, made of plastic, it was cramped, spewed dirty exhaust, and broke down frequently. But Wolle says it was beloved by East Germans, who often had to wait 10 to 15 years to get one. When they finally did, it was like a part of the family.
Like a cat or a dog or so, yeah. My lovely Trabi, yeah.
After the wall fell, East Germans could buy any car they wanted. Demand for the Trabi evaporated. But maybe not forever. Today, Herpa, a company that normally makes model cars and planes, hopes to revive the old affection. It's teamed up with manufacturer IndyCar to bring back the Trabi, this time as an electric car. IndyCar CEO Ronald Gierszewski shows me the prototype he debuted at the Frankfurt Auto Show this fall. It's a shiny powder blue. Looks a bit like a longer version of another retro car, Britain's Mini.
Is that grip for opening? Yeah, for opening.
Oh, yeah.
No,
sorry.
No, it's...
There we go.
I just pulled off some paneling. It is just a prototype. Gershevsky hopes a sturdier version will hit the roads in the next 3 years or so. He's looking for investors and a partner to mass produce the car. He says most of the interest has come from outside Germany.
We have learned that the Trabant, it's a symbol of the German reunion, and it's a very positive symbol, and it's well known all over the world.
Here in Germany, nostalgia has revived demand for some old communist brands. But in the wider world, retro cars like the new VW Beetle and the PT Cruiser have failed to catch on. Without an experienced car maker backing the new Trabant, one analyst told me the flop risk is very high. In Berlin, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This week, a powerful U.S. senator is set to introduce a bill laying out his idea about financial system reform. But naturally, the idea of regulation is a wee bit different from what the banking industry is thinking. Here's Marketplace's Steve Henn.
Senate Banking Committee Chairman Chris Dodd thinks the Fed should get out of the business of banking regulation. But big banks don't like that idea at all. Scott Talbot is at the Financial Services Roundtable.
We like the Fed as a regulator. We think they tend to be very rational and very thoughtful, and that is something, those are qualities that you look for in regulators.
But critics say banks and the Fed were too cozy. The Fed failed to police the mortgage market for years and didn't see this crisis coming in time to stop it. Talbot argues the Fed's changed.
They've already imposed new credit card rules. They've already proposed new overdraft rules. They're already proposing executive comp rules. And that's just in the last couple of months.
But Senator Chris Dodd and others argue the Fed has enough on its plate just managing monetary policy. And they say it needs to remain independent from politics to do that job well. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
And finally, Paris is known for ambiance and romance. Well, this past weekend, it was the breakup. A divorce fair there drew 4,000 people. And the event there featured lawyers, weight loss programs, and tarot card reading. From Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.